Support for WPR comes from UW-Madison Sandra Rosenbaum School of Social Work's part-time MSW program, offering hybrid classes with on-campus sessions every other Saturday. SocWork.wisc.edu. Support for WPR comes from Bagels Forever, available fresh daily at the store in Madison and the frozen food case in grocery stores throughout the state. Bagels and bagel chips can be shipped anywhere in the U.S. at bagelsforever.com.
Good morning. It's the Larry Mueller Show on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Larry today, he returns tomorrow. We start our show this morning talking about strokes. We're going to find out how to prevent them, the risk factors that make you more likely to have a stroke, and what you can do once you do have a stroke. And if you've got a story to share, we'd love to hear it this morning in hopes it may help help others. Our guest, Dr. William Taylor. He's a neurohospitalist and vascular neurologist with Ascension, Wisconsin. And Dr. Taylor will also share the warning signs that someone's having a stroke and what you can do to save them. So have you or a family member had a stroke before, and what was that experience like? Who made you feel supported in your recovery? Let us know what you're doing to reduce your risks of stroke. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email anytime, talk@WPR.org. Dr. Taylor, welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on today.
So I mentioned you're a neurohospitalist, and I must admit I am not familiar with that term. So what does it mean to be a neurohospitalist, Dr. Taylor?
That's a great question. So it's basically just a neurologist who treats patients only on the inpatient side and in hospitals. So I really manage acute care neurology.
And how long have you been doing it now?
So it's 3 years with Ascension, Wisconsin, but I spent 4 years in residency and a year in fellowship in vascular neurology, which is essentially stroke neurology.
And Dr. Taylor, why is it important for us to understand stroke prevention and who's at risk in all of this?
Oh, that's a great question. So really just kind of going over what a stroke is. A stroke happens when blood flow to the brain is interrupted, either by a clot, which is called a ischemic stroke, or by bleeding, commonly known as a hemorrhagic stroke. So it's important because rapid recognition and treatment are crucial to minimizing brain damage and improving outcomes. So essentially, the faster a stroke is treated, the better the chances of recovery are. And studies show that every minute without treatment leads to loss of nearly 2 million brain cells. So it's why it's important to recognize it and act quickly.
How common are strokes, Dr. Taylor?
Relatively common. They're one of the most common causes of disability and death in the U.S., unfortunately. Really, one thing is recognizing a stroke is why it's so important. There's an acronym, a tool we use called BFAST to recognize the symptoms and kind of reminder of the urgency of it. So it's balance, sudden loss of balance or coordination, eye movements, sudden vision changes, facial asymmetry or facial drooping, A for arm weakness, speech, S for speech, and then T for time.
Let's go through it. It's BFAST is the acronym here that we're going through. Mm-hmm. And so it is balance, facial asymmetry, arm weakness, speech, and then time. Mm-hmm. And we look for these as symptoms of a stroke, Dr. Taylor?
Yeah. It's just kind of ways you can recognize symptoms in someone else or even in yourself.
And when we're talking about the two different kinds of strokes, from clots or from bleeding, do those present as different symptoms or do they look the same from the outside?
Great question. So essentially from the outside, they look the same, okay. Unfortunately.
And so balance first, if somebody's losing their balance, how sudden would that have to be? How drastic would it have to be for us to take notice and see it as a warning sign?
If you're seeing it really rapidly, so within the course of a couple of minutes, even if it's a slow kind of insidious onset, those can be sometimes dangerous. But in coordination with the other symptoms, that's when I would be concerned and seek seek help immediately.
So balance alone may not be enough to, but you've got the rest of this BFAST to deal with. So facial asymmetry, I would imagine that would be something that would cause immediate concern, whether it's happening to you or you are witnessing it happen to somebody you know.
Absolutely.
Because that just doesn't, I mean, unlike losing your balance or getting dizzy, that's not just something that just happens, I don't think.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, dizziness, imbalance is something that most people experience. Even I experience, I'm younger. I still get that. I think dizziness can be caused by so many things, but in coordination with something like a facial asymmetry is huge. And those are usually why people come in.
As we're going through BFAST here, arm weakness, and there would be arm weakness could be a symptom of other cardiovascular problems, I would imagine as well.
Yeah, weakness, particularly whenever we're talking about the A of BFAST and arm weakness, is weakness usually in one arm or numbness.
Yeah, we've got a question here from somebody who couldn't stay on the line. But when we're talking about facial asymmetry, Dr. Taylor, what does that mean? How does it present? What am I looking for?
Yeah, so you'll notice a facial droop. It's a lower facial droop that will happen suddenly. You'll sometimes even notice speech changes with that. So maybe you're drinking something and it's falling out of one side of your mouth. That can be it. Sometimes people will recognize it when they're looking in the mirror. They'll see something isn't quite right that morning. But it's typically pretty rapid, or you'll notice it at some point in the day whenever you're looking in the mirror.
Mm-hmm. And so that would be the drooping on one side. What's causing that?
That's really that brain, the blood flow to the brain is interrupted. Mm-hmm. The brain is a machine, and if you interrupt one of the circuits like that through either a clot or bleeding, that interruption of the signal causes the weakness to appear.
Balance, facial asymmetry, we get to arm weakness. Is that something that I can notice from others, or is that something that largely would be self-diagnosed?
Kind of a combination of the two. Whatever happens first, ultimately, whether you recognize it in yourself or you see it in someone else, just acting on that. And like I said, the faster a stroke is treated, the better the chances of recovery. Time is brain, which is what we often say in medicine.
Time?
So the earliest time is brain.
Writing that down, time is brain. The quicker you can get to this, you can deal with this, the better you can protect your brain.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's really why EMS activation is crucial. Paramedics can start life-saving measures, provide early stroke assessments, and transport patients to the most appropriate facility as quickly as possible.
So we get to the speech part, and as you mentioned, that may be part of the facial asymmetry, but how else would we recognize the speech part from whether we're self-diagnosing or as we're noticing it from others?
Great question too. So speech can be something such as slurred speech, where the speech, the tone doesn't sound quite right, or it can even be the ability to produce or even understand speech.
So comprehension could be part of this.
Exactly.
So confusion, if I were to be confused and find some of these other BFAST elements, that would be a reason to dial 911 immediately?
Absolutely.
The final part of BFAST, I think we've explained now. T for time, time is brain. It might as well be B for time.
Right. Yeah. It's extremely important. The faster you act, the better the outcomes, the better we're able to treat people and the better chances of recovery.
So there are two different types of strokes. One that is caused from clots, one caused from bleeding. There is an acronym that we can use to self-identify or identify from others, BFAST, which includes balance, facial asymmetry, arm weakness, speech, and time, which is brain. And this all sounds very scary, Dr. Taylor. So I would be interested in knowing what are the best ways to prevent a stroke in the first place.
That is a great question. So really, While some risk factors for strokes, such as age and genetics, are beyond our control, roughly 80% of strokes are preventable. And here's how. The top one, I think, is the most important, is managing your blood pressure. So it's the number one risk factor for stroke. Regular monitoring and medication adherence are essential. Honestly, a lot of these preventables can be done by a close relationship with a primary care physician. So like, blood pressure is the most important. You really want to control diabetes and cholesterol. High blood sugar levels and elevated cholesterol can lead to vascular damage to those blood vessels, increasing the risk of stroke. Smoking doubles the risks of stroke by accelerating the damage to those arteries. Limiting alcohol consumption, especially here in Wisconsin. Alcohol is so commonplace, but yeah. Excessive alcohol use can increase blood pressure and contribute to heart arrhythmias that are major risk factors for stroke. Eating a healthy diet. The diet that I always recommend to my patients and I try to eat myself is the Mediterranean diet, which emphasizes healthy fats like olive oil and nuts instead of, you know, butter. So what I tell my patients is, you know, instead of using butter, use olive oil. Instead of baking or instead of frying your fish, you bake it, or you bake your chicken, eating more nuts. And then maintaining a healthy weight, taking medications as prescribed, and exercise regularly, at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise per week, and maintain healthy blood pressure, weight, and cholesterol levels.
It's interesting, as you run down this list, how I see, anyway, some similarities to ways to prevent other cardiovascular diseases like heart attacks.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And honestly, interestingly enough, even if we look at the history of stroke treatment and other medical conditions, a lot of them evolve around, especially when you talk about like ancient Chinese medicine, there were some things that were kind of odd that they emphasized, like body humors and energy, but treatments such as diet and lifestyle modifications were sort of foreshadowing modern medical prevention strategies. And they do overlap because a lot of them involve blood vessels, either in the brain or the heart.
You mentioned as alcohol and its relationship that the state of Wisconsin has to alcohol, but as I think about it, drinking alcohol could, to some degree, present some of these symptoms or mask some of the symptoms that we went through with the BFAST: slurred speech, lack of balance, some limited arm weakness. Could drinking alcohol disguise some mask symptoms of strokes?
Absolutely. Yeah, it can, even if you've had a stroke, it can even make those stroke symptoms you've had before reappear and become worse.
How do you figure out whether or not somebody's had too much to drink or somebody's actually had a stroke?
It requires a nuanced neurologic exam that's not really possible to explain, but it's really a part of an exam. That's part of the reason why it's important to, if you are having these symptoms and they're new, even if you've been drinking, it's worthwhile sometimes to get checked out.
You mentioned weight, and in the news recently with pharmaceuticals are the effect of weight loss drugs like Wegovy. Do we know yet have any impact on prevention of strokes?
There is some data. I can't... Obviously, I have to stick to evidence-based recommendations, but there's data re-emerging that it is improving outcomes in certain patients.
Interesting.
Related to cardiovascular and stroke. So I think that's more to come. It's very exciting, but so far it seems promising. And that's, I think, the best I can leave with that.
Our guest is Dr. William Taylor, a neurohospitalist and vascular neurologist with Ascension, Wisconsin. And we invite you to the conversation about strokes, what can be done to prevent them, how to treat them once they have happened, and what you want to know about this clotting and bleeding that can happen in the brain. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Emails are always welcome at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Taylor next here on The Larry Miller Show. Coming up today at noon, we'll talk about Alzheimer's disease and the people working hard to find a cure, including a veterinarian from Lake Mills who's biking to the top of the mountain to fundraise for the cause. But right now, we're speaking with Dr. William Taylor, a neurohospitalist and vascular neurologist with Ascension, Wisconsin. We're talking about strokes, what we can do to prevent them, and what happens once they occur. Call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. William Taylor, when somebody comes to Ascension, Wisconsin and presents with a stroke, what are your steps? What happens next?
That's a good question. Yeah, it's really about our whole mission in our model. I think maybe the best place to start to answer that question is about improving care. So Ascension really is committed to improving access to care for all, with special attention to the poor and vulnerable. So it drives our overall treatment goals, our system goals. So we have a spoke and hub model, which allows us to strategically replace resources across the state so that we have rapid access to diagnosis and treatment. So when you have a patient come into any Ascension facility, there's a couple things that happen. We have standardized stroke protocols that guide imaging and triaging that guides a patient to get the right type of imaging done. And with our advanced imaging technology, we actually have artificial intelligence that's creeped in over the last decade in medicine, but it's something we utilize. It's a software called Rapid AI. And this AI technology helps detect strokes faster in real time, allowing our doctors to make quick and accurate decisions. And then we utilize those transfer protocols. If the patient isn't at a site where we perform certain types of treatments, we transfer those patients to that site. And a part of that, we also use telemedicine, telestroke, to give immediate access to stroke specialists at rural hospitals. And then once they get triage and treatment, they get to our main site and they get comprehensive multidisciplinary stroke teams that vascular neurologists like myself, neurointerventionists, rehab doctors, cardiologists, neurocritical care experts, to provide holistic stroke care from acute treatment all the way to rehab. And then after that treatment's done, they get post-stroke follow-up clinics. We have dedicated stroke clinics that ensure patients receive ongoing care, medication management, and lifestyle counseling as a part of a whole picture to really take care of patients long-term.
Dr. Taylor, as long as you've been a neurologist, a vascular neurologist with Ascension, Wisconsin, how has this treatment evolved and what do you see on the horizon for treatment?
Oh, this is a great question. I could really talk about the history of stroke treatment and the history of stroke for a long time. It's amazing how quickly it evolves. And even now I feel sometimes overwhelmed by literature. But I mean, really, if you think about a stroke, kind of going briefly over the history of it, it's been recognized for centuries with descriptions dating back to ancient times. The term apoplexy was what was initially used for it, which is meaning struck down with violence, because stroke was thought to be this act of the gods. But as physicians at the time really lacked the knowledge of brain function and circulation. We talked a little bit about Chinese medicine. Sometimes there's been other things I think people realized about diet and lifestyle modifications that foreshadowed modern stroke prevention strategies. But you know, as we go through kind of the major breakthroughs of the last 20 or 30 years, in 1996, that was when one of the first big clot-busting drugs came out that could be administered within a short window after stroke onset. 1996. Yeah, before then, it was harder to treat. You just admit them to the hospital. Wow. So this clot-busting drug came out, and but the treatment, though, this was really the ushered in the era of a time-sensitive stroke intervention, because you could only give it within a certain amount of time, so emphasizing rapid diagnosis and treatment. In the early 2000s, we saw the introduction of something called mechanical thrombectomy. It's basically clot retrieval. It's a procedure using catheters to remove large clots directly from brain arteries. Initially, the procedure was only effective in limited cases, but advancements in catheter design and imaging have made it the gold standard for really large strokes, or we call them large vessel occlusions. And now patients who receive this clot retrieval or thrombectomy within 24 hours of stroke onset can regain significant function. And then now, as we even look into the past decade, kind of what I alluded to as far as Ascension, Wisconsin's mission to driving improving access to care for all. Artificial intelligence and machine learning have transformed stroke diagnosis and treatment. So technologies like rapid AI allow for real-time stroke triaging and imaging analysis, ensuring patients receive timely interventions. We also integrate this now with telemedicine or telestroke services that enable stroke specialists, which are a rare thing, to access and treat patients remotely, improving access to high-quality stroke care, even in rural areas. So ultimately, it's been kind of a progressive march. And with that, part of my job as a vascular neurologist is integrating a lot of these new changes into system-level care that improve access to care and change models to improve overall quality.
We heard on the Larry Mueller Show yesterday a little bit about AI and how AI has can hallucinate when it doesn't have all the data that it needs to make us. How does rapid AI differ than some of the AI we're seeing put it forth now online, like ChatGPT and Google and others?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I'm going to do my best to kind of muddle my way through, and I apologize if I'm not completely accurate in this. But the best I understand it is like the AI models such as ChatGPT are large language models that take large sets of language or text, and they integrate that into answers based on, I'm not completely sure, but then rapid AI basically uses kind of the same different type of technology that uses imaging and like perfusion timing, like when contrast goes through blood vessels, and then there's a certain, like I said, I don't completely understand, but basically I think my suspicion is AI, there's like certain types of AI that are good for certain tasks, and they've been developed and refined within certain protocols. And so rapid AI was based off, I think, machine learning, and then eventually AI was integrated into that to help assess blood vessels. But I'm not completely able to answer that question. But it's not like something that just automatically knows, hey, this patient needs a clot retrieval. They just kind of give you a probable answer. And then it says, okay, then they get the neurologist or neurointerventionist who decides that the patient should get a treatment.
I get the sense that unlike ChatGPT or Google's Gemini, this isn't a large language model, but it is an imaging model that looks at all the other images and finds what other images have presented as and what they mean and can better assess in that way.
Yeah, it's got like thresholds and criteria that say, hey, this patient fits within this thing. I see some vessel that doesn't match the other side. This is a possible thrombectomy. I wouldn't say it's the smartest AI. It's still very useful, but it's useful enough to help. Because this has been the problem with modern stroke care, is that you have, and really the issue with healthcare in general right now is there just aren't enough doctors. There aren't enough specialists. And so in order to triage those patients, we have to utilize technology.
And the spoken hub model that you spoke of, that Ascension Wisconsin uses.
Yeah. And within that, it's incredible how much work has gone into that over the last couple of years to develop this spoken hub model to strategically place resources across the state to improve diagnosis and treatment. With limited resources and really elevate the standard everywhere so that patients, even in underserved areas with geographic disparities, socioeconomic disparities, racial and ethnic disparities, get the same high quality access to care, which is really honestly, that's part of the reason why I love working for Ascension.
Dr. William Taylor, our guest, and we go to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Christina in Glenwood City, good morning. Oh, we lost Christina. She wanted to ask about chewing aspirin for symptoms of a stroke, doctor.
Yes, I think there was actually a study that was done on this for Haiti where they didn't have access to imaging, where they found that it was actually beneficial, and this probably relates to something else, but I would say if you're having symptoms of a stroke, I would take an aspirin, and then obviously we'll call 911. If you can't get to the center quickly, probably taking aspirin's reasonable. Hopefully that answers some of that question.
Yeah. Dr. William Taylor is a neurohospitalist and vascular neurologist with Ascension, Wisconsin, and your questions are welcome here at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. If you'd like to know more or would like to share your experience, we'd like to hear it. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. This is WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on the Larry Mueller Show. Larry returns tomorrow with a wildlife update. It's Wildlife Wednesday. Ecologist Scott Craven returns to the show. And we'll also find out more about the North America's oldest golden eagle, which happened to visit Buffalo County last month. But right now, we're taking a look at strokes, how to prevent them, how they are treated, and what we need to know and how to be fast. Dr. William Taylor, our guest, he's a neurohospitalist and vascular neurologist with Ascension, Wisconsin. And you're welcome to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. And Sherry, I want to thank you for emailing us because I believe I missed part of the be fast, Dr. Taylor. Sherry says that be fast also includes the E in there, which includes eyesight and vision changes to be aware of. I apologize for missing that. Dr. Taylor, let's go through it here. What do we need to know when it comes to eyesight and the identifying a stroke?
I'm really grateful for that part of the BFAST as well. So for eyes, that can be sudden vision changes, blurred, or even double vision.
I misspelled BFAST, and I thank Sherry for correcting us on that. Is there, you mentioned, you know, the importance of having a relationship with a primary care physician. You mentioned the importance of having access to healthcare in rural areas throughout Wisconsin to immediately treat symptoms of a stroke. Are there demographics that we can identify that would make people more susceptible to a stroke, Dr. Taylor? And if so, why?
Oh, this is a great question. Really, because part of what I try to do every day at a systems-based level is addressing disparities in care, and that's part of what Ascension tries to do is addressing these stroke disparities in care. Because stroke care isn't just about medicine and technology, it's also about access. So disparities exist in multiple dimensions, so including race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, geographic location, and even gender. So these disparities impact timely treatment, quality of care, and overall outcomes. I think there are a couple key ways to talk about this. For racial and ethnic disparities, there's a higher stroke incidence in Black Americans. They have nearly twice the risk of first-time strokes compared to white Americans. Wow. Hispanic and Native American populations also experience higher stroke rates than white Americans. There's also delays in treatment that occur. Black and Hispanic patients are less likely to receive timely treatment, which is crucial as we alluded to, and they have worse outcomes, unfortunately. And part of that kind of also ties into lower utilization of stroke prevention measures. Black and Hispanic patients are less likely to receive the appropriate medical treatments for prevention. And then there are socioeconomic disparities, so lower access to care for certain stroke centers. So patients in lower income communities are often treated at hospitals with lower stroke quality and fewer resources. They have higher out-of-pocket costs, and there are insurance barriers. And then within the state of Wisconsin, you obviously have a very large state that has changes and gaps in geographic locations. So there's rural and urban gaps. Rural areas have fewer stroke-certified hospitals, less specialists, leading to longer transport times, delays in receiving treatments. Telestroke programs that we utilize help bridge the gap, but adoption varies depending on health systems. And then, you know, gender disparities, I think is also something to be aware of, is that women are more likely to have severe strokes and long-term disability. They're less likely to receive the acute treatment, partly because of misdiagnosis, just under-recognition of symptoms. And there's also disparities in, emergency response, EMS activation delays. Minority and low-income patients are less likely to call 911, delaying important treatment. There's also implicit bias in triaging sometimes that happens. So I really think that there's definitely efforts within our site to reduce disparities that we try to activate and look at. Addressing implicit bias, expanding our telestroke programs. We also have community outreach programs and interventions within the system level. But unfortunately, the disparities exist, and really what the best way I think to kind of get connected is to find a good primary care physician, recognize the symptoms and act on them if you see them.
And let's go to your questions now for our guest, Dr. William Taylor, the neurohospitalist and vascular neurologist at Ascension, Wisconsin. You can join the conversation 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. Dave in Green Bay, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Dr. Taylor, yes, I'm a 3.5 year out hemorrhagic stroke survivor. And I just had a couple comments and then a question for you, too. As far as your recommendation, you were just saying someone had asked about taking an aspirin for a stroke. I mean, would that be contraindicated with a hemorrhagic stroke? I mean, ischemic stroke, I could see yes, but hemorrhagic stroke, no, but you really don't know. So if you take an aspirin, you got a hemorrhagic stroke, you're going to just bleed more.
Yeah, I hesitated even whenever I was thinking about this, because I was thinking about it. There's some work that was done whenever Haiti had, it was a couple of years ago, where they had patients who were coming in with stroke-like symptoms, and they didn't have access to imaging. They actually found that, on average, patients benefited when you're able to give them aspirin, even without the imaging, just because of the difference between ischemic or blood clot strokes and bleeding strokes. But I would say, when I'm answering this question for Ascension Wisconsin, or not for Wisconsin, for most patients, if you're able to get to a site quickly, I would say just don't worry about the aspirin. That would be probably my advice. But if you're at a site where you have limited access to care, it might be reasonable to consider it. But I think every case is unique. And you're absolutely right that aspirin is contraindicated in bleeding strokes.
Dave, you know your stuff. How are you doing in your recovery?
I'm working on it. I've had a lot of help, and I've done a lot of just things maybe outside. I've tapped into acupuncture, and I work with our CP center here, and doing aquatic therapy has been a really big help too. You can kind of work without gravity, and your balance is, you can really work on a lot of things. The question I had though was, a while back on public radio, they were talking about psychedelic drugs and how they can help rewire the brain. Is that a possibility? And with stroke survivors? I mean, because that's where, I'm kind of messed up, is with my left side was pretty much paralyzed, and I've been working on that, but it's getting all the neural connections. I mean, the muscles seem to be working, but it's just the neural connections that go to those. So I didn't know if there's been some research with psychedelic drugs and stroke survivors.
Dave, I'm glad to hear you're on the mend. And Dr. Yeah. Taylor, you know anything about that?
Yeah, stroke recovery is a highly individualized journey. It sounds like you're headed in the right direction, but you've really hit on an often overlooked but crucial aspect of recovery in stroke patients, is that many stroke survivors experience obviously depression, anxiety, emotional ability, which can significantly impact their motivation to participate in therapy and even neuroplasticity. So I think obviously resources are important in a successful recovery journey, which it sounds like you've had so far. As far as psychedelics, psilocybin related to stroke therapy and neuroplasticity, I haven't seen any, I'm not aware of any major studies. I know there's been a lot of great work done with depression, PTSD, and some of those major trials comparing them to standard therapies. I can't really comment on the efficacy related to those, but I do know that at least getting mental health resources is extremely important in stroke care, but I'm not aware of any psychedelic studies related to stroke recovery.
And Mark, I'm going to get to your call in a second, but I do have a follow-up email that sort of fits with Dave's recovery efforts. An email from Lee. A family member of Lee's had a stroke about a year ago and was treated. He had therapy for a time immediately afterward, but is still having some problems. Simple problem solving, tying shoes, a shuffling walk, and it gets him angry and frustrated. And he's saying that therapy doesn't help. Would continued therapy be beneficial? Is there a way to convince this person to get more help? This is more of a psychological aspect of the recovery of strokes. What can they do?
That is a great question. So you really, when you're thinking about the timeline of recovery, they hit on a couple things. There's this initial recovery that occurs initially with the acute phase in the first 3 months or so. Then up to about 6 months, you see this progress continue, but at a slower pace. But after about 6 months, recovery may plateau. ongoing rehab can help, medication management, but ultimately at this point, really lifestyle changes are a part of it, including assistive devices, technology, adaptive strategies for daily tasks. Sometimes that's really what it is you're using other parts of your brain to make up for the damaged tissue. So I think it just really requires, sometimes occupational therapy can help with that. Therapists can help. It's really a multidisciplinary approach to help people live the highest quality of life.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Taylor, for that. Now we'll get to Mark in Wisconsin Dells. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. I just had an interesting report. sometime around 10 or 12 years ago, my wife had the symptoms of a slurred voice and a sagging face, and I just knew she was having a stroke, and I called the ambulance. I followed the ambulance to the hospital, and by the time I got there, she was fine. And we were told she was having heartburn.
What?
And I wondered if you'd ever run into that kind of thing before, because, you know, I was a pre-med student at one time and interested in that stuff. And I, you know, this was a stroke. And to me, it was classic. But it was brought on by heartburn. And by the time she got to the hospital, she was fine.
Well, it sounded like you did the right thing, Mark, and err on the side of caution, and you saw the symptoms and called EMS right away. But Dr. Taylor, I'll ask you, heartburn symptoms appearing like a stroke?
So I obviously cannot specifically comment on this. I do want to say, like, what the actual diagnosis might have been, because I'm not there. But I would say you did the absolute right thing.
Yeah.
And really emphasizing that there are gender disparities in care, partly because under recognition of symptoms and women, atypical stroke symptoms, it's possible that she had what's called a transient ischemic attack that is a type of, it's commonly called a mini stroke that can recover quickly. So it's worthwhile. Hopefully she still has some medical care and follow up.
Mark, how's your wife doing today?
She's doing fine. You know, I always wondered whether it could have been related to she takes a bunch of medicine. Sometimes she takes her pills without eating enough and gets a real upset stomach, and she does get heartburn quite a bit, and it can be very severe. I know myself I've had. So I don't know, you know.
Yeah,
Nobody ever followed up at any point to where concerned about anything else. She checked out fine.
But as we've learned today, Mark, time is brain. So when in doubt, make sure you get to a medical emergency physician as quickly as possible. And Dr. Taylor, there is a follow-up email here from Suzanne in Manitowoc. Suzanne thinks it's important to note that sometimes when you experience a droopy or dead side of the face combined with some arm problems, it may not always be a stroke, she says. Her husband had these symptoms and went through lots of tests, which didn't find anything. Well, that's not true. It turns out he had fungal meningitis.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which
is not nothing.
No, so that's a great point. Part of the reason why we're emphasizing these symptoms so much, and you're absolutely right, the emailer is absolutely right, it's not always due to a stroke. The brain is a machine, and if you interrupt the signal, whether that be through a stroke from ischemic bleeding, or whether that be through maybe meningitis from pressure, or maybe even a tumor, sometimes seizures can change, the strength on one side and cause very similar symptoms. We call them stroke mimics. There's a litany of them, a complex migraine. They're all in that. But ultimately, seeking treatment, you get these symptoms, I would recommend just getting checked out.
Yeah.
You guys did the right thing, get checked out.
Thank you for that email, Suzanne, and thank you, Mark, for the call. We invite you to our conversation with Dr. William Taylor, neurohospitalist and vascular neurologist with Ascension, Wisconsin, at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Dave in Kenosha, we'll go to you next. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question related to stroke is I was diagnosed with PFO in the heart. And I have a positive right to left shunting with, I don't know if you're familiar with elevated AA gradients and the ABGs, but all of this is as a result of a post-COVID lung diaphragm paralysis. Mm. But the fact about the, kind of a weird complication. But I've been short of breath for 5 years, and in the workup, these things have all kind of been discovered that this is what's going on. But I was told that the PFO, unless I have a stroke first, they probably wouldn't repair that. And I just wondered if, I know there's like 1 in 4 people walking around with PFOs that have no problem at all, but I just wondered if that's something that you're familiar with, PFO with a unilateral diaphragm paralysis, and any more increased risk for stroke from that? I'm not sure.
A lot of these terms are over my head. Dr. Taylor, PFO?
Yeah, it's a patent foramen ovale. It's a structure in the heart that is a normal variant. About 1 in 4 is he alluded to, that can be, that there is an association with increased stroke risk, but we only close them in patients who there's been a shown benefit to closure, probably because they were getting closed. I wouldn't necessarily think about it as a pathologic or bad thing. I'm not as familiar with unilateral diaphragm paralysis and stroke risk. I have to look into that, but I would say, if you've not had a stroke, then it's not beneficial to close it.
You mentioned before that genetics could play a role in strokes. Are strokes hereditary?
There are certain types of hereditary stroke syndromes that are very rare. But I would say certain types of patients who maybe are predisposed to some of those risk factors, genetically, where they have certain variants, or structurally, maybe they're more predisposed to arrhythmias, things like that could kind of play into it.
Where are we today when it comes to a prognosis after a stroke? If you do survive a stroke, what's the recovery process like?
Well, that's a great question. So stroke recovery is a highly individualized journey, and it varies depending on the severity, type, location of the stroke. I just typically categorize recovery into 3 phases. You have your acute phase, which is the 0 to 3 months. This is where the brain undergoes the most rapid healing. Most patients regain some function, often with intensive rehab, and that's really the key, is intensive rehab. Neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to rewire itself, plays a crucial role in this period, allowing undamaged areas of the brain to take over lost functions. Early physical, occupational, and speech therapy can greatly enhance recovery. After that 3 months, there's the subacute phase. The progress continues, but at a slower pace. Even during this period, therapy remains critical. This is often a period of adjustment where patients and caregivers start to understand the long-term implications of the stroke and focus on regaining independence of daily activities in conjunction with the deficits. So emotional and psychological support, including counseling, really should be a part of this phase too. Then after the 6 months, that's more the chronic phase, 6 months to a year or so is after that. So you have recovery may plateau. During this phase, ongoing rehab, depending on the case, can be essential. Medication management, lifestyle changes can help prevent future strokes. And long-term rehab strategies typically include assistive devices, adaptive strategies for daily tasks, and really just continued monitoring of risk factors such as high blood pressure and diabetes. Some patients will experience lifelong changes, but consistent medical follow-up and lifestyle modifications can maximize the quality of life. So I really think, and someone had alluded to this too, additionally, I think emotional recovery is an often overlooked but really crucial aspect in the rehab process. Many stroke survivors experience depression, isolation, loss of value and meaning that they used to have in their lives that can significantly impact their motivation to participate in therapy, which is, participation in therapy is critical. Their support and mental health resources are essential components of what I'm successful recovery journey.
I want to get to as many emails as we can with the short time that we have left here, or if you want to call quick, 800-642-1234. Elizabeth in Madison emailed us asking about the connection between sleep apnea and strokes and whether or not there is an increased risk there.
Sleep apnea can cause hypertension, which can lead to, which is the most impactful risk factor. So I would say sleep apnea is critical to treat.
Joe in Wausau asks, he's wondering, what causes the blood to clot in the brain, Dr. Taylor?
That is a very long answer. It's multiple things. So basically, the simplest way I can break it down is that, you know, some people just have stickier blood based on genetics. It can be inflammatory conditions like COVID we sometimes saw, you know, even the flu, any type of infection, sepsis, pneumonia, things like that can increase your risk of clotting, inflammatory processes. You have the artery walls that also get damaged by inflammation that can narrow. The tubes become narrow. The blood can become sticky. There's a number of things that can go into that. That's the simplest way and shortest answer I can give.
Sure. So that would cause the clotting. What could cause the bleeding types of strokes in the brain?
Oh, yes. Also a great question. Sorry, I didn't address that. The bleeding is mainly related to just damage sometimes in the blood vessels. It can be deposition of certain types of protein in the brain, but typically it all kind of comes back to blood pressure.
Yeah.
Blood pressure. So higher blood pressure increases your risk of both ischemic and hemorrhagic, so bleeding and clots. So ultimately, blood pressure is really the big thing to manage.
Here's a story for you, and thank you, Gene and Mosney, for emailing us. Gene's dad died of a cerebral aneurysm at the age of 49. This was back in 1967. Gene was not home at the time, but the symptoms were like a stroke, she says, when he first was discovered. The general practitioner who saw him in the emergency room had never had anyone with an aneurysm before. The only way we knew for sure, says Gene, it was from an autopsy, sadly. So he had a lot of headaches during his life, and Gene and their brother get headaches and migraines. They're very common for them. So neither of them have had any issues with a stroke or an aneurysm, but can these aneurysms be hereditary? And what should Gene and their brother think of these headaches?
Yeah, some of the aneurysms can be. I would say that the key thing that you want to do is to have a doctor that can talk to you about your family history, your other risk factors in depth, and then help decide on the best evaluation and screening for you. Hmm. I can't really necessarily get that over the phone, but
sure.
I would say it would be worthwhile to connect with a specialist to really review your history.
It's interesting how much of this goes back to having access to adequate healthcare.
You're absolutely right. That's the thing that we work on at a system level with Ascension. So really, honestly, sustainably improving access to care for all with special attention to the poor and vulnerable is a key part of Ascension's mission.
Yeah.
It drives how we structure our system, whether it's expanding access to telestroke care in rural Wisconsin or changing our protocols to ensure that every patient, regardless of background or disparity, receives high-quality stroke treatment.
What's the best I can do as a non-medical practitioner with somebody, a loved one who's had a stroke? How can I support them in their recovery?
Really? That's a great question. I love that. That's really important, just being there for them sometimes to talk to them, making sure that they're able to get to their appointments, making sure that they're getting, advocating for them sometimes in appointments. It can sometimes be even researching things, you know, to help them. Because admittedly, you know, when you see a provider, they may not have all the time in the world, or they may miss something. Your family member may be overwhelmed with the condition and not really listen to the information. I mean, that happens to me sometimes in doctor's appointments.
Sure.
Or, you know, someone saying that it's something you're not processing. So just being there for them, listening to them, talking to them, I think is really critical.
Yeah. Support. Support in whatever way that you can support them in a positive way. And we've got an hour coming up discussing Alzheimer's disease, Dr. Taylor.
Oh, wow.
Do we see a link between dementia and strokes?
Yes. Actually.
Wow.
The Venn diagram of my brain is overlapping. So I would say certain types of strokes can cause cognitive impairment and dementia. There are certain types of bleeding strokes that are related to the conditions. I don't want to necessarily go into depth in, but that cause that. So yeah, there's some relationship. I would say it's not quite as dementia is this big umbrella of conditions that overlap. But there are some links. Blood pressure increases. High blood pressure, once again, is kind of the key thing that links that increases your risk of dementia in later life. But it's a great question, but it'd probably take a full hour to fully answer.
We'll have to have you back, Dr. Taylor. But my takeaway today is time is brain, and I thank you for a fascinating discussion.
No, thank you so much for having me.
Dr. William Taylor, a neurohospitalist and vascular neurologist with Ascension, Wisconsin. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry today. Larry returns tomorrow here on WPR News. Listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Good afternoon. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Glad you're here. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease this hour and the people who are working hard to find a cure. Dr. Cindy Carlson joins us, as well as a name you know, Bill Stork. They're our guests. Dr. Carlson's a geriatrician, the director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, and a nationally recognized expert on Alzheimer's disease. She's here to answer your questions. Bill Stork is the owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, which I'm sure you know, one of our regular guests here. He's organizing a fundraiser for Alzheimer's research that you have to hear to believe. We also want to hear from you today about your experience with Alzheimer's disease. If your family has a history of it, maybe you've cared for somebody with it, or you have questions about it. Join us this hour, 1-800-642-1234. Share your stories. Email us, talk@WPR.org. Bill, welcome back.
Why, thank you, Lee.
And Dr. Carlson, so grateful to have you this afternoon. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics here. In your mind, I'm going to start with the bigger picture. How close are we to finding some sort of cure for Alzheimer's disease?
We've made so much progress in the last 10 years. It's been amazing. I think before we used to only be able to diagnose Alzheimer's after someone had died, and now we can actually diagnose Alzheimer's in the clinic and with some blood tests even. So there's a lot of advancements that's been made with diagnosing it, which is the first step to developing treatments. We're not quite at the cure stage yet, but we are making progress on figuring out what's causing it and then trying to get the therapies that are going to help us protect our memory and keep us thinking stronger, longer. So we're looking forward to new, possibly even prevention therapies. We're very close, though, so it's been an exciting 10 years especially.
And how important is early diagnosis?
Early diagnosis is really important because we think there's some changes that are tougher to reverse compared to stopping them in their tracks early on. So a lot of our studies at University of Wisconsin and our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center in our Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute focus on really trying to find those changes early so we can get those preventive therapies, whether it's a medicine or lifestyle changes like biking across a mountain range or other health factors that we try to help people think about living healthier lives and protecting their brains.
Yeah, in much the same way we talked about last hour about diagnosing and treating strokes, it seems like we've come a long way in a short amount of time. Why is that? Why are medical advancements seemingly accelerating right now? What's happening?
Well, it took us 100 years. We had a meeting back in 2006, and it had been 100 years since Alzheimer's had first described Alzheimer's disease in the brain. And at that point, we didn't have blood tests or brain scans or other things to find those changes. And really getting these important brain scans to be able to look in people who are living and people who don't even have the symptoms yet have made a big difference, because now we can look at people who have these brain changes early before it affects their memory, and then we can hopefully do better prevention studies. So that's been the real key, is that we now have these brain scans, spinal fluid tests, and then recently blood tests, so we can help find people early and get the right people on the right therapies.
So, Dr. Carlson, we're diagnosing Alzheimer's disease before it's actually outwardly presentable as a form of dementia?
It depends what people mean by Alzheimer's disease. So In medical research, a lot of people will say you have Alzheimer's disease if you have any of the brain changes like amyloid and tau protein buildup in the brain that are contributed to Alzheimer's disease. If you, but in everyday practice and in, you know, our families and communities, we really think about Alzheimer's disease as when somebody has advanced memory changes. Mm-hmm. So that's where there is a difference, is that we think those Alzheimer's brain changes happen probably 20 years before we get memory symptoms. So now we're picking up something we didn't know about for 20 years. And now we can, that's why we're starting to study people who might be at risk for getting it.
What's the cause of Alzheimer's?
That's a great question. So we know there's some proteins that build up. So these proteins, not regular proteins like that we have in our diet, but a protein called amyloid and another one called tau that build up in the brain. But there's other things too. So it's not just amyloid and tau. It's inflammation, you know, irritation of the nerve cells. It's blood flow to the brain. So there's a lot of other factors that we're not quite sure about yet.
How common is Alzheimer's?
It's very common, unfortunately. Mm. So, you know, when we're in our 60s, it's probably about 10% to 5 to 10% of us might have some mild forms of dementia. I see your eyes getting big over there.
Yeah, that's a big number.
But if we're in our mid-80s, though, probably about half of us will have some form of mild dementia and some Alzheimer's disease. So it's more common as we get older. We don't, you know, we don't, not everyone's going to get Alzheimer's dementia, which is good. And that's what we're trying to study. Why is it some people get it and some don't?
Is Alzheimer's hereditary?
Probably about half of Alzheimer's is hereditary, but there's a lot of factors in there. We don't fully understand it. Thankfully, the type you see on different news specials where half the people in the family get Alzheimer's dementia, thankfully that's pretty rare. So those really strong genetic diseases causing Alzheimer's are pretty rare. But there's a lot of people who it runs in their family, and is it a mix of their healthy lifestyle patterns or lack of, or is it a mix of what kind of health problems they have, or is it other genetics? Again, we're not sure what about it makes people more prone to get it in certain families.
But we're learning.
We're learning, yes.
Dr. Cindy Carlson, director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, our guest. And before we get to your questions for her, I want to bring in Bill Stork, who you know, friend of the show from the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Bill, tell us a little bit about your family's history with Alzheimer's disease.
Well, that would be by way of my mother. And if I go one step beyond that, my grandfather was affected as well. And we're on the radio, so you can't see my shirt, but if people were to Google Minds Over Mountains UW or go to our Facebook page at Minds Over Mountains, you would see our logo. And on our logo, those eyes looking down over us are my mom's. And my friend Glenn Fuller, the artist, knew my mother very well and managed to capture her kind in those eyes. And you know, my mom was that lady for whom if a neighbor got sick, the ambulance better be quick, or my mom would be there with a casserole, a pitcher of iced tea, and a card before the ambulance got there. And the thing that we first started to notice, like when my mom was in her late 60s, early 70s, she always had the most elegant handwriting and knew exactly what to say. And somewhere along the line, we started to notice that her handwriting was a little off kilter. There was a little wobble, and she got descended through the stages of Alzheimer's over the years. And my dad fell right in behind her and cooked and cleaned and bathed and fed her. It was pure till death do us part.
Oh, I feel like I understand you a lot better now, having listened to you for years and then learning about your mother. What was going through your head at that time? What was this experience like for you?
Well, what I was on the outside to some extent because they were down in Illinois and I was up here in Wisconsin, but I would go back home often enough. You know, Dad, some of the things that made impressions upon me was, one, the beauty of my dad's relationship with my mom and how he supported her. And he managed to keep her out of assisted living until the last 3 years of her, I'm sorry, the last 3 months of her life. But that was long enough for me to gain an absolutely endearing respect and appreciation for caregivers and CNAs, that hyper-compassionate army that take care of people with Alzheimer's and dementia. And one of the missions of Dr. Carlson's group is to support those people who support patients with Alzheimer's disease.
So you've got this fundraiser, Minds Over Mountains. What do you plan to do to raise money for the cause?
Well, the way that all took place and how it is that I got hooked up with Dr. Carlson is, you know, as we were talking, Dr. Carlson and I, and you and I in the lobby, when you have it in your family, every time you search for a word, every time you can't come up with a name, you think, oh man, here it comes. And I decided, rather than just sitting around waiting for it to come and get me, I was going to do something about it. And about that time, I found myself in conversation with a friend, Becky Jeffers, who works in the lab at the initiative with Dr. Carlson. And she said, check out the initiative. I checked out the initiative, and I found out, man, those people are the point of the arrow with regard to early detection, intervention, education, support, and advocacy. And I got hooked up with Steve Ramig, the director, and I said, man, I want to help. I know that it's probably too late for my mind, but I don't want my kids to have to worry about this dehumanizing monster. And he said, Bill, it may not be too late for you. That's how close we are.
Wow.
And I said, man, settle up. Let's go. And things that we've learned from the initiative and others is, and common sense for that matter, lifestyles that will delay the onset of cognitive decline. And I feel like I'm in class with a teacher looking over me right now, Doctor. It is vigorous physical activity, vigorous mental activity, and maintaining relationships, quality relationships in your life. So the week of June 23rd, my good friend John Humphreys from Lizard Head Cycling Guides and my family, and there's still room on the trip if anybody out there wants to join us. We're going to saddle up in Telluride, Colorado.
Beautiful.
And we're going to, oh my God, beyond words.
So and horses?
We're going to be riding bicycles. It'd take a horse a long time, and it might even take a few horses.
It's going to take a bicycle longer.
Well, and my wife is on the trip, so don't put it past her, because she rides, and she may be riding beside us on a horse.
You're in the mountains, Bill. I mean, these aren't hills. This isn't the Driftless area. You're Telluride.
But the Driftless is a wonderful tool to get ready to go out there. Because you go climb those hills in the Driftless over and over and over again, and the next thing you know, it's a mountain.
Well, what are you going to climb?
Pikes Peak. The Queen stage will be on June 28th, and we're going to saddle up in Colorado Springs at about 6,000 feet altitude, and we're going to climb on our bikes and clip in, and we are not going to stop until we see a sign that says Pikes Peak, 14,100 feet. Minds over mountains.
Minds over mountains, indeed. And how long do you expect that trip to take, Bill?
Yeah. 6 hours.
How long will it actually take, Bill?
You know, as I think Dr. Carlson would agree, the first question in life is not, you know, what can I do? The question is, what needs to be done? So the answer is, when we get to the top, that's when we'll quit pedaling.
Bill Storick, our guest, you know him as a friend of the show from the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, who is climbing a mountain for Alzheimer's research. Dr. Cindy Carlson, our guest, director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, and I see a lot of questions for the both of you here, and we'll get to them when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on WPR News. Good afternoon. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest, Bill Storick, who you probably know from the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, he's organizing a fundraiser for Alzheimer's research with a big event coming up that you can attend before he climbs a mountain in Colorado on his bike. Dr. Cindy Carlson also with us, director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute and an expert here to answer your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. And I want to get to some of those questions right now, Dr. Carlson, and we'll start with Nick in Green Bay. Nick, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just got a question for you, a little back history. I fell off the back of a semi, landed on my forehead, got knocked out for 4 hours. And in my research, I see that anybody with a TBI is high risk for Alzheimer's. Is that true or is that just not correct?
We know there are a lot of things that affect our brain health that can affect our risk for Alzheimer's, but there are a lot of things we can do to help protect our brain as well. So you're right that there have been some studies showing that traumatic brain injury can affect our risk for dementia down the road from Alzheimer's or other types. But there's things like Bill was talking about, exercise, eating well, sleeping well, other things we can do to help protect our brains too. So it doesn't mean for sure that you develop dementia down the road. It heightens our risk, but there's a lot of things that we can do to help protect our brain and reduce that risk too.
That amyloid and tau buildup that you mentioned, are there ways that we know that we can cleanse the brain from that?
Not yet. We're doing some studies to see if we cleanse the brain of amyloid, if that helps prevent someone from getting Alzheimer's. But those studies are still underway. But to your point, Bill, about biking across a mountain, our team here at Wisconsin has done some research that even if you have some amyloid buildup in your brain and you exercise, it seems to help protect your thinking abilities. So if we can think well, no matter how much changes have happened in our brain, that's really what our end game is to make sure that our thinking abilities stay strong. So a lot of work we can do right now while we're waiting for the breakthrough therapies.
I've seen that sleep has been tied to helping with prevention.
Yes.
Is that true?
That's very true. So, and there's a lot of research being done in that area too, but we know things like sleep apnea can lower how much oxygen you have to your brain, cause blood pressure to go up and some other changes. So being treated for that, like wearing a CPAP mask or other interventions can really help protect our brains. And then just getting a regular sleep schedule. So trying to get in a routine, trying to make sure we get a good consolidated section of sleep helps our brains to process the extra protein buildup and things at night so it gets a nice fresh start the next day.
Funnier, as I get older, I find it a little more difficult to get a regular night's sleep, or it can be intermittent at times. It's not as easy as it used to be.
It's not as easy as it used to be.
Dan in Coloma, we'll go to you next. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, my Lewy body dementia, and I'm wondering if that's a hereditary type situation.
You cut out a little there, Dan. Would you repeat your question? I'm sorry.
Lewy body dementia, is that something that I need to be concerned about being hereditary?
Yeah, so Lewy body dementia is a different type of dementia from Alzheimer's. It's a different type of protein buildup called alpha-synuclein. So it's a different deposit that occurs in the brain. But it's really common that it can happen with Alzheimer's dementia. And we're finding out more and more that usually people don't have just one type of dementia. Usually it's a bunch of different causes together. But the Lewy body dementia, some of it can be hereditary, and some of it are factors we don't know yet. So that's why here at Wisconsin, we're expanding and not just focusing on Alzheimer's disease, but really moving into better understand people who get both Alzheimer's and Lewy body and those protein buildups together. How can we tease apart what's causing what, and how can we, you know, use that information to help us prevent both of these diseases?
Dr. Carlson, there's a follow-up here, an email from Eau Claire. They're wondering if violent dreams are a precursor to Lewy body dementia?
So violent dreams, in some cases, if somebody has a condition that's called rapid eye movement, which is REM behavior disorder, where people act out their dreams, maybe get tangled up in the sheets and swing and hear people talking about punching their partners at night and things like that, knocking lamps off the table. That can be part of this REM behavior disorder, and sometimes that can have some violent dreams with it. But you can have violent dreams for other reasons. You know, a lot of veterans have post-traumatic stress disorder and other conditions that that might contribute to violent dreams. So violent dreams by themselves doesn't necessarily mean you have that REM behavior disorder, but if they're accompanied by those other behaviors, the thrashing around, sometimes it does. And REM behavior disorder has some association with Lewy body dementia and Parkinson's. It doesn't mean for sure you'll get it, but again, there's just an association there.
Let's go to Martha in Menominee next. Martha, good afternoon.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. I'm wondering, I'm a little, you know, behind on this. Is Alzheimer's a subcategory of dementia? Maybe you could speak about the difference of those two. And also, I noticed in our president a lot of, over the years, I guess what they call paraphagia, and struggling for the right word, and then also a loss of a train of thought, not keeping the question asked of him as the question he's actually answering. And I'm wondering if you're seeing signs of this in our president.
Martha, thank you. Not to address a single person, but in general, some of the symptoms that maybe Martha mentioned.
Yeah, so Martha, your first question is extremely important. So clarifying what dementia is versus Alzheimer's. I get that question pretty much every week in my clinic because it's just not very clear. Dementia is the condition we see in a person. So when somebody has memory and thinking problems, like some of the symptoms you mentioned, so if somebody is losing their train of thought, if they are having trouble concentrating, trouble finding the right word or forgetting things, and if those memory or thinking problems are to the degree that it affects a person's day-to-day life, that's when we call it a dementia. So if somebody's still able to, you know, if somebody forgets where they put their keys and forgets words, but they're still able to go to work or manage their household, then that's sometimes a condition called mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, we'll call it sometimes, but it's not a full dementia if they're able to kind of keep up with their day-to-day task. So, and then, like you said, we have to figure out what's causing that dementia in someone. And that's where we're able to use some of these newer tests, these specialized brain scans called PET scans or spinal fluid tests or blood tests to see, is it Alzheimer's changes causing the dementia, or is it Lewy body changes causing the dementia, or a stroke causing the dementia? So dementia and Alzheimer's are not the same thing. But like you said, Alzheimer's is the most common type of dementia.
I hope that answers your email, Amy and Monona, who asked the difference between Alzheimer's disease and mild cognitive impairment, and that's a perfect answer. I appreciate that, Dr. Carlson. So if the question is, what can we do? That's why Bill Stork is here today, because he is climbing a mountain on his bike, and he's taking a bunch of people with him. I understand he still has room if you'd like to go from Colorado Springs to, how far are you going again? It is Pikes Peak?
Yeah, Pikes Peak itself is about a 36-mile ride and a 7,700-foot climb, something to that effect.
We've got a link to Bill's fundraising page at WPR.org/Larry with today's show note page. But you also have an event that we're all invited to here coming up June 15th. Invite us out.
Come one, come all. Yeah, we've got your Father's Day plans covered on Sunday, June the 15th at the Tyrannina Brewing Company in Lake Mills, Wisconsin. And we've made some calls. We have arranged for absolutely perfect bluebird sunny skies, 75 degrees and no mosquitoes. But in the event that that falls through, we'll be at the pharmacy, and also in Lake Mills, pharmacy with an FH. But what that's going to all be about is we'll gather somewhere in the vicinity of noon. And about 1 o'clock, we will pay our gratitude for the people who have sponsored us, to the people like Dr. Carlson, who are doing the hard work. And then just before we kick off the music, we're going to have a very special tribute and recognition to caregivers and CNAs. I just cannot say enough about the role that those people play as the point of care administrators. And then at 1 o'clock, it is going to be Gary McAdams and the Mama's Boys, which is a band that has never existed until that moment in time. It may never exist again. But for those 3 hours and as many encores as you can stand them for, they're gonna go at it. And Gary McAdams is as a singer can sing anywhere from Merle Haggard to Fred Eagle Smith and Billie Holiday.
Nice.
And he's going to have a rhythm section behind him, Pete Olig and Steve Doherty, and his ace guitar player, Stephen Douglas Peck. We're going to have Oscar Wilson, Oscar Mr. 43rd Street, first ballot Chicago Blues Hall of Fame. Oscar Wilson is going to come up and sing some songs with us, and we're looking forward to introducing the world to a hot young vocalist and fiddler named Lucas Yeager. And
so you got blues and bluegrass, you got rock and roll.
We call it roots music, man.
Yeah.
We call it soul music.
Yeah.
And there'll be lots of opportunities to give there. We're also going to have a big old silent auction, and there will be some amazing offerings on the silent auction. Our friend Jennifer Kay, Jennifer Kay Artist, you can go to her site. You can go to our Facebook page, Minds Over Mountains. She's going to be donating a custom pet portrait that will blow your mind.
I'm in on that.
She practices an art form that it's almost extinct, and she is a master at it. We have everything from Milwaukee toolkits from Burning Metal. It's Wisconsin, for God's sake, so you have to have a cooler full of meat.
Could have gone any number of ways, but as, we landed on the cooler of meat.
And as well as a remote control cooler, my wife and I are going to invite some people out for a farm to table dinner.
Oh, wow.
At our house. And
this is a lot more than just a bike ride up to Pike's Peak.
Oh, yeah, you can say that.
Yeah. And again, this is taking place on Father's Day, Sunday, June 15th at Tyrannina Brewing, starting at 1 o'clock.
We'll start at 1 o'clock. There'll be food from Crawfish Corner, Crawfish Junction. At the Tyrannina Brewing Company, you're welcome to bring in your own food. Please, no beverages.
Sure.
Yeah.
Where will this money go and what will it do, Bill?
It will go to Dr. Carlson, and then whatever she chooses to do with it from there.
Well, what does this funding help support, and where can it go that will do some good for all of us?
I have to tell you, we are so thankful for people like Bill who come out of the woodwork to share their stories, to share what motivates them, what drives them. We are amazingly privileged to live in a state where people support each other. Mm-hmm. Again, our research teams, our research participants, our community members who are reaching out there to support caregivers. We have an amazing network in our state. So what that money does is that money helps us to go towards finding out what are the other causes of these dementias that we're missing. We can figure out what's Alzheimer's, but what about the other protein buildups in the brain like was brought up? What about Lewy body and these other causes? So we're trying to figure out how can we better identify these using other types of what we call biomarkers. How can we use these biomarkers to find the other causes of dementia? How can we get good prevention treatments? So again, we're doing some trials now, but we need more funding to experience and understand what about these other things? If we, if we sleep well and do all the right things in our lifestyle and still get dementia, how else can we prevent it? So we're looking at other ways, not just amyloid, but other ways to try to prevent the dementia. And then all the other thing we do, too, in the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, you know, Bill's brought up the extreme importance of supporting caregivers, CNAs, and we have a network throughout the state to support clinics in rural areas, urban areas, trying to help support clinics so they can provide good dementia care in their own home communities. So the funding from events like these really help support our initiatives to bring research to the whole state so it can really benefit people in diverse communities, everyone from the person at risk for dementia, the person living with it, and the caregivers, and the communities themselves.
And to pile onto that, Lee, mm-hmm. A point that was made to me, it's going to be an absolute thing of beauty, and we will appreciate every single nickel, whether it's 50 cents or $50,000 come June the 15th. But as Dr. Carlson pointed out, they have research projects and they have needs that are shovel ready, and they are now. And so you don't have to wait if it is your inclination to help us help them. And you can do that by going to Minds Over Mountains UW or straight to the UW Initiative to End Alzheimer's. And they make it very easy to help us out.
Dr. Carlson, take us into the future, if you would, and what you would see from the research that you've done, the direction it's taking, and the acceleration of our understanding of our own mind and what we might find in the future with proper funding.
With proper funding, what I would envision would be that we'd go into our doctors in our, let's say, in our mid-40s, and we'd go in there and say, what's my risk for a dementia down the road? They'd do a blood test, find a few risks for certain protein buildup. They'd put you on a preventive medication, do some thinking tests to help protect your memory. get you on an exercise regimen, and some other probably lifestyle changes, and that we would see either a prevention of dementia or a delayed onset, where maybe instead of getting it, you know, in our 60s, like Bill's mom, or in our, you know, 70s, like my grandmother, instead, maybe they'd live to be in their, we'd live to be in our 90s and not have any memory symptoms.
I was going to shoot for 100.
100. But
how
good.
How close do you think we are to something like that, of early detection in our 40s and being able to delay it to our, until we're centenarians?
I think we're there for detecting Alzheimer's disease. Prevention, I think we're probably about 5-7 years away, possibly with some big studies if they work out. But we still have the other, you know, the treatments right now. There's a new treatment that clears out amyloid if you already have dementia, so you already have memory loss. But it only, you know, slows down the progression. It doesn't stop it in its tracks. So we got some other work to do to help really get the other components besides just the Alzheimer's contributing, that amyloid only.
What I hear is hope supported by science, supported yes. by the community who is committed to finding early detection and treatment.
Exactly, yep.
Dr. Cindy Carlson, our guest, director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute. Bill Stork, who is biking up a mountain. Minds Over Mountains is where you can support his work, as well as the Father's Day event at Tyranina Brewing, with something for everybody, including the music and a cooler of meat, if the price is right. And we still have some questions and callers. I want to invite you to our conversation. I don't mean to exclude everybody, but I've got my questions here, too, that I'm curious about, but our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to go to Sean in Eau Claire next. Thanks for hanging on, Sean. Good afternoon.
Hello. I am wondering if conditions like ADD or neurodivergence or autism have any bearing or have any effect on the possibility that you might get Alzheimer's or dementia?
That's a great question. So we don't know yet if those conditions increase our risk of Alzheimer's dementia per se, but we do know that, you know, having attention deficit disorder, so having, you know, by definition, that it, trouble concentrating, trouble paying attention, that impacts how much we remember. So if we have trouble concentrating, we're not going to remember what we were told or what we read. And so there's increasing research on how to better understand how does ADHD or autism or other, you know, spectrum disorders, neurodiversity, how do those factors affect our risk for dementia? So they might be different changes in the brain that cause those conditions, but there may be some common things we can do to help people. That's a great question, and we still need more research in that area, but it's gaining traction. More people are studying that, which is good that you bring it up.
Is there a good cognitive practice, PT, for my brain that I could do to help?
That's a great question. So in addition to physical activity, and Bill brought up a few of these points about staying socially active, mentally active, we usually advise people to pick something you enjoy that's challenging, think, you know, cognitively. There's no set test, you know, crosswords or Luminosity or other specialized brain games that are going to help you. They've done some studies that show if you do a certain brain game over and over again, you get really good at that brain game. But how well it translates into remembering where you put your car keys may not be the case. So really pushing yourself to be active, using new brain paths. So like when I took a pottery class and had to learn how to throw on the wheel, and
yeah.
It uses a different part of my brain than I'd ever used. And so things like that, which are challenging. The downside is you want to make sure if you're already struggling with some memory problems or thinking problems, you don't want to pick something that's extremely frustrating. So if you're having a lot of language problems, you're already having some problems in that area because of some memory changes over time, you don't want to pick learning French or something that's going to be really taxing, because that might just be too much and just be more frustrating than anything.
I'm getting frustrated because we're running out of time. So let's take a quick break, and then we'll continue with our guest, Bill Storick, who is participating in Minds Over Mountains here coming up in June. And you are invited to join him and Dr. Cindy Carlson, director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, and your calls when we continue here on The Larry Mueller Show. Coming up tomorrow on The Larry Mueller Show, Larry's back with your Wednesday wildlife update. Ecologist Scott Craven returns to the show. Also, North America's oldest golden eagle made its appearance recently in Buffalo County, and we'll learn more about it with Larry tomorrow here on WPR News. But right now, with the time we have left, we have Dr. Cindy Carlson, director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, and friend of the show, Bill Storick, who's participating in Minds Over Mountains, who will be climbing Pikes Peak in Colorado coming up at the end of June, and invites you out to the fundraiser at Tyranina Brewing on Father's Day, starting at 1 p.m. at 6:15. And I keep glossing over this, Bill, because I knowing you from the show, I hesitate to ask, but you mentioned it. You expect to have some degree of Alzheimer's because it's in your family, and it is something that you are working in the preventative measures that we know to stave off the best you can, and part of that includes Minds Over Mountains.
Well, you do the best you can with what you have where you are when you're there.
Yeah.
And just plucking a point that Dr. Carlson made, which is that there is the physical disease and the changes in your brain, and then how well can you think around them, and how can you function with what you've got going on upstairs? And that's one of my takeaways from today.
Mm-hmm. The other one is that if we do this now, and you're able to raise the funds that Dr. Carlson can then take and turn into the better understanding of our brains, that you are able to stop the cycle from to your children.
Well, I can either stop the cycle or know that I did every single solitary thing I could to affect the outcome. It's the old serenity prayer. If I do everything I can do to affect an outcome, I can live with the consequences.
Bill, what's the best thing we can do to support you?
What you can do is to support Dr. Carlson and give is a really big deal. And as I said before, 50 cents, $50,000, they are all appreciated at every level. And as I said previously, the need is now. You don't have to wait until June the 15th to do that. You can go to Minds Over Mountains UW. You can go to our Facebook page, Minds Over Mountains. That way you can keep track of what we're up to. And I'm going to be posting some goofball videos of me getting ready to climb. Lee asked me, how do you get ready to climb a mountain while you live in Wisconsin? And yeah. I'm playing that out on Facebook. But the other thing that you can do is be aware. My family's venture through the healthcare system and my family's time in assisted living gave me an amazing appreciation, CNAs and caregivers. We've mentioned it a dozen times, which is nowhere nearly enough. Be kind and supportive of those people when you possibly can.
Do we have enough caregivers?
We don't. There's estimates that we have about 130,000 people in Wisconsin who are living with Alzheimer's dementia. And we have about 190,000 caregivers, and most of those are unpaid caregivers, people who are taking time off work to care for their mom, their dad, their sibling, their neighbor. So, and again, anyone who's lived that journey, it's tough. It's sleep deprivation, the isolation. So I think, like Bill said, just being there for somebody who maybe needs some extra support, driving someone somewhere, sitting with someone, letting someone have lunch with you and cry on your shoulder or share their joys. I mean, it's a journey that we're all in together.
My mom was well into her Alzheimer's journey, and Dad came up to visit and brought Mom with him. And my good friend Glenn took my dad to the tractor pulls at the Jefferson County Fair and give the poor guy a day off. And I took my mom to a bluegrass show at the Cafe Carp, and which was actually really interesting because it triggered something in her. And she was gone for the most part mentally, but her foot started to tap at the sound of that music. And
I'm a firm believer that music is the magic in this life. And Dr. Carlson, have you found any science that might support that?
There are some studies looking at music really bringing back people's memories, making people functional again. It's not in everyone, but there's a lot of facilities now are looking to see what playlists do people like, where are they in their thinking abilities, are they in their 20s and their 40s, and really trying to find playlists that really bring them out.
Speaking of which, the Tony Bennett story, and Dr. Carlson is looking at the ceiling. There is an amazing 60 Minutes that features Tony Bennett and the muscle memory that he experienced when his accompanist sat down at the piano and it all came back to him. Mm. He was Tony Bennett again, to the extent that well into Alzheimer's, they arranged a concert at Madison Square Garden with Lady Gaga. And as soon as he saw her walk across the stage, it was on.
It clicked, yeah.
And it was 100%, which not to that extent, but we experienced one of those miracles along the way. And I would love to hear, send them to me on Facebook. There are some amazing moments of beauty within all of this. And my mom was well into Alzheimer's dementia. They went to the physicians, went to the doctors together for a checkup. My dad went first. He was strong as an ox. He could split a cord of firewood with his bare hands at 70-some years of age. And my mom went in, and there really wasn't much to examine because she was pretty non-responsive at that point. And she looked at the doctor, and, "Dr. Patel, how's Bill?" "Well, he's doing fine." "You know he has heart disease in his family, don't you?" She steps out from behind the fog. "Did you order a stress test?" "Well, and he's doing fine. Did you order a stress test?" The next morning, my dad was on a treadmill. They took him off at 90 seconds on the treadmill, and he had a stent 36 hours later. His greater coronary artery was 85% obstructed.
Is there a science to explain that sort of seemingly miracle, Dr. Carlson?
There is actually research at UW that Dr. Gilmore Bukowski is looking at moments of lucidity, is what we call those moments of where people come out of the fog. And so we have colleagues studying lucidity as well.
Wow.
Or where faith meets science.
Exactly, yep.
The things that we don't understand quite yet.
Exactly.
That is amazing. Dr. Cindy Carlson, our guest from the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, Bill Stork, a voice I'm sure you know, who is doing Minds Over Mountains here coming up in June. And a reminder, the fundraisers at Tyranina Brewing in Lake Mills, Father's Day, Sunday, June 15th, starting at 1 o'clock, with a cooler of meat and much, much more. They're profound stories, and we have some more here with the time we have left, and I want to make sure we get to as many as possible, and we'll start with Teresa in Appleton. Teresa, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I've loved everything I've been hearing so far on today's call, and unfortunately have been living the journey as well. My grandmother had dementia. My mother now has Alzheimer's, and we just placed her in a care facility. My question is, I'm a firm believer in epigenetics, that, you know, your family may load the gun, but your lifestyle pulls the trigger, so to speak. Not the best analogy, but so I'm doing everything I can to try to not follow in their footsteps in this path. You touched on it a little bit about early testing. When and how would I address that if I'm in my mid-50s with my physicians? What is a good time to start trying to do some baselines or looking at some testing, even though I know some of the progress is years down the road yet?
That's a great question. I think, you know, a lot of people are asking that because now we have this test, but it's not widely used yet. So I think, honestly, some of the best ways that you and people like yourself can become and better understand your risk is to get involved in research. So again, our Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center has studies for people just like you, people who've had a parental history of dementia, who don't want to follow in their footsteps, are doing everything possible to see what other blood tests showing, what else can we do, are there other prevention studies. So again, our Alzheimer's Center has a website you can go to, or adrc.wisc.edu to get involved in research. But again, our Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute is also working to help primary care doctors and physicians know what to do with these blood tests in clinical practice so that, you know, right now they're not checking them if you're cognitively healthy because they don't have a clear set idea of what to do next. but we're hoping to train them so that once we have prevention therapies, they'd know how to use those blood tests in clinic.
Sounds like a win-win. And Teresa, thank you so much for sharing your story this afternoon. Let's go to Brian in Michigan next. Hi, Brian.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My son is involved in the final year of his PhD at a university, working in biomedical engineering on a protein to help treat Alzheimer's disease. And wondered what your level of concern was regarding funding cuts that we're hearing about. I know they're talking about disaster planning and just what you see in the big picture and all the progress we've made about a potential roadblock with funding at the federal level.
Brian, thank you. And you know, Bill, you mentioned that there are projects that are shovel ready right now, good to go. But then there's also the question of federal funding. And I know, Dr. Carlson, you also work with veterans from the U.S. Armed Forces. And there have been questions on that side, questions with the National Institutes of Health. Where are you at?
Yeah, so again, a lot of our cutting-edge research that really has the highest scientific quality is funded by federal sources. So things like the, you know, organizations like the National Institutes of Health, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the Veterans Affairs has research arms as well, and also Health Resources Service Administration. So again, a lot of our research is funded by federal sources. So protecting those federal sources is critical. And the federal sources also help support our universities, which support things like the labs we do the biomarkers in, making sure that they're safe, making sure the money's spent in appropriate ways so we're all transparent. So again, I think the federal funding is critical. This is why fundraisers like this are critical as well, though, is because there's always ups and downs with federal funding. And I think it's a little early to tell where the dust will settle for this, but I think that you know, being advocates for good medical research to continue. We have one of the best medical research infrastructures in the world in the United States, and really we need to protect that gem because we're so close to making these advances, and any setbacks for research like this, care for veterans, would really be detrimental. So again, my clinical practice is with veterans in the VA clinic, and I see veterans every week, and they're amazing individuals who have probably unique risk factors with, you know, some higher risks of depression or post-traumatic stress disorder or certain medical conditions, blast injuries. And so we really want to make sure that we protect those who've served our country and be able to do research and offer the right therapies for them as well.
Brian, I appreciate the question, and Dr. Carlson, thank you so much for the answer here. I do have a logistics question. We'll go from Michigan to Minnesota here and get Ron with us next. Hi, Ron.
Hi, I just wondered if the guy is going up Pike Peak, have you modified your bicycle at all with maybe a lower gear for going up and heavy-duty brakes for going down?
Or a battery?
You know, batteries are the great equalizer, but I'm not there yet. And you are absolutely correct. Yes, thanks to the good folks at Trek Bicycle, I have modified and geared down because it's a long spin.
Yeah, so Trek has helped you out, get something specialized for you?
In a sense, they certainly have, yes.
I appreciate hearing that. So Bill Stork, who from the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, usually answers all your questions about your beloved pets, here inviting you to participate in Minds Over Mountains, where he will be climbing to Pikes Peak at the end of June and is inviting you to the fundraiser. Bill, one more time, let us know about it.
Absolutely. Father's Day, we've got your plans. There will be food, courtesy of Crawfish Junction. You can bring your own food, please. No beverages of any sort. Music by Gary McAdams and the Mama's Boys. There will be a silent auction. We will be paying tribute and giving thanks for caregivers and recognizing caregivers and CNAs. And we'd love to see you. That'd be fantastic.
Something I took away from your buddy Glenn with a story about your parents when they came to visit is other thing that we can do is find the caregivers and take care of them. That we might not be direct caregivers ourselves, but I think all of us in one way or another can play a role in being an indirect caregiver.
Exactly. Yeah.
I can't imagine what just an evening off must be for those people.
Invaluable. And more meaningful than a meaning night off than any of us would have in our given day-to-day life. Dr. Carlson, question I have is, as I get older, I find myself a little bit forgetful, and I want to know where I would draw that line and ask a primary care physician for some guidance if I'm just forgetting my keys, if I'm just can't remember why I came into the room in the first place. Where do I begin to wonder?
That's a great question. We get that question a lot because we all go through that. We forget words. We have a bad day and can't remember where we parked our car. So that's why I took a picture of where I parked my car on my way up here today.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bill's got it written on his hand. You can't see here. So
I feel better.
Yeah, yeah. So those are common things we experience. And things like sleep, medication side effects, hormone changes. There can be a lot of things, thyroid changes that can affect our memory. So that's why I always encourage people to bring it up early and talk with your physician. If you have a family history of young onset dementia, so parents in their 60s, 50s who develop dementia, then you know, make sure that your physician knows about that because that might be a little different type of workup. But again, there are a lot of things that are not Alzheimer's that can cause our memory not to be as sharp. So make sure you get those addressed, work through those, because a lot of times they can really help by addressing those factors.
Dr. Cindy Carlson, director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute. Bill Stork, a voice you know. Minds Over Mountains, Father's Day, Sunday, June 15th, the Tyrannina Brewing, and a link on our webpage at WPR.org/Larry. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow. Thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patinod, technical director Jeff Robbins, and executive producer Jill Nadeau. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Larry Mueller Show.